contextual aspect of judgment and the presentness of the past through the judgment of others, and then relating that to somehow that all we know is somehow with us. The habitual context of insights give rise to an orientation. Had you at all tried to relate that to what Lonergan calls the remote source of value judgment? He talks about specifically two aspects, the proximate and the remote source of value judgment. Do you think there is a link at all?
You'll have to refresh me. What is the remote source?
Well, the remote source, he says, this is actually in the, it's in one of the chapters in Common Sense and Insight, but he brings it out a lot more in the appendix to Topics of Education, which is a very helpful appendix, in the notes. And he says that it is remote and completely unnoticed because it's transmitted through tradition, but you don't see it because it's not a set of premises. Like that's why it's seemingly unintelligible. There's nothing there to draw a direct conclusion from. But it's remote because it's not in the foreground of the mind. It's always sort of lurking in the background, just like you said it. And I'm wondering if this received intelligibility that Lonergan is pointing to with the remote source of value judgment, could that be what you call the, quote, movement from above?
Yes, it is what I mean. It is, and I'm going to have to take that into account as I come back once again to rewrite this, because it's another source then in Lonergan that would provide a context in his writing to try to integrate some of the things that I'm asking about. So thank you very much. Go ahead.
It's a very short section. It's only the section on the remote source of value judgment is about a page long, not even. It's one of those
in the appendix to Topics?
Well, he brings the idea up in Insight, but it's explained as a culture, as a way of life,
yeah,
in the appendix to Topics. But I think it's something that needs to be drawn out a lot. So
that's very good. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. That was fantastic. I don't have so much a question as maybe a few addenda to Sean's stuff from Thomas. And I want to focus on two things, fantasia and memoria. I've been preparing stuff on memoria and specifically on the phantasm, so it's sort of uppermost in my mind.
Sure.
The only thing I want to say on phantasm in itself is that it's becoming clearer to me that when Aquinas and others talk about the phantasm as something to be read, so the whole business of intus legere, they're actually quite serious. That the phantasm as visual isn't just a picture, but it is a meaningful. What they have in mind, in fact, is the act of reading a text and receiving meaning in that sense. So just that's all I want to say there, and develop it in the direction of memoria. Memoria in Aquinas is the place where custom is received. It's one of the components of prudence, precisely as receiving the wisdom of others. Mm-hmm. So again, you capture in memory through phantasm historical intelligibility, historical meaning,
okay,
that you inherit. You also have in memoria skip that one. The last bit is memoria is a trained memory, is a habitus. And therefore, it is in fact a place where intelligence and reception, if you will, meet. We can talk about it some more, but
yeah,
there
like
are
to,
definitely
like
resources in Thomas
on, okay,
for going in the direction you're suggesting.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Bill, thank you very much, Bob, for that tracing. To me, it seemed that you were making a continuity from Aquinas through Lonergan to Heidegger on this level of elemental meaning. And may I rephrase it to see if I've understood
of course
what you're saying correctly? That in Aquinas' terms, that you're dealing with the process of imagination, so that while it is the case that presentations may come through the senses, that
is going to be in the representation of imagination and active sense that Aquinas will see the possibility of intellect being able to grasp anything, that it's going to be under the light of the quote, the age of intellect, question, that sensation begins to have a meaning, and that that is what Longinus would speak of as being attentive to grasping enough of sense to have a critical mass, and that that will begin to verge on being intelligent, so that what the intellect is going to grasp as intelligible will not be sensation itself, but that constructive imagination that will be the intelligible in act, so that you'll have formal intelligibility insofar as the intellect is going to be immersed, engaged in what it is constructing for itself from the impact of experience. And that will be elemental. That will be elemental. That will be the pre-articulated identity of the intellect in act, of the intelligible in act, from which the actual understanding will occur.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah,
so
that is what I'm trying
so
to get.
That it isn't as if there's raw data that we somehow grasp the intelligibility of, but it is the act of formulating configurating that data that is going to be the intelligible in act, and that will reflect the whole background of the tradition, so that it is, as the previous questioner said, that it is a kind of text and a pre-verbal articulation.
Thank you. That's great.
And therefore, what you have done is to show that continuity from Aristotle through Aquinas, through Lonergan, to Heidegger, by which there's a kind of reading of being in the process of imagination, an implicit reading of being that will be capable of being articulated through insight, that insight will then take that
understanding. That's the kind of that's the relationship I'm trying to do. That's
really brilliant. Thank you very much.
You.
Yes, Bob, I'm dovetailing on these two comments because mine is in a similar vein, but I think that this category of received intelligibility is very important. And you've used the word sort of minor in connection with Heidegger's Verstehen in this. I would kind of bracket that because I think that I would go even farther than the word pre-verbal was used here, but my thinking is that all of our categorization functioning is, in fact, verbal in the sense that it's linguistic, although it's not spoken. So I think to really get to the heart of this category of received intelligibility, what we need is an account of how empirical consciousness arises developmentally. Because only then can we get really a take on where you're starting from. That is a very important limitation. It limits the base from which we begin to have insights in a lot of sense, limits the quality of those insights, the speed with which they occur, and the progress that we make toward higher viewpoints. So I think that you're right in concentrating on this category, be attentive, but I would grant great importance to this category of received intelligibility, and again, stress a developmental account.
Okay, thank you.
Jeremy?
Bob, that was very provocative in the best sense, and I enjoyed it a great deal. One thing I'm curious about is it's not completely clear to me why you want to talk about the thing, this minor formal and actual intelligibility, specifically with respect to empirical consciousness. It seems to me concretely what I think about is the formation of my children. Which is the proximate instance I have of trying to impart a tradition to somebody. And it seems to me what I can impart to them has to do with the data about which they can ask questions. So, for instance, my son Abraham is named after Abraham the patriarch, and he knows he's named after Abraham the patriarch. He's three. He doesn't know who Abraham the patriarch really is, but he's beginning to apprehend some of those stories and so forth. But it seems to me that there's just a gradual accumulation of insights that's happening there. And that has to do, and my role in it has to do with making available certain stories and so forth, and also maybe, in some sense, provoking certain kinds of questions. Now, my son Thomas, who's 8 months old, I don't think has understood anything yet, has had any insights yet. You know, he's operating on the level of sense, and there's a proper integration.
He's 21.
Jeremy, I'm talking though about Abraham receiving the story.
Right, but it seems to me that there.
I don't know whether I've got the right language for it. That's why I'm asking.
But this is what confuses me is it seems to me that there are proper insights operate there, that he is having insights into the relationship between these characters or what the story is and so forth, and that so the association of the thing just with empirical consciousness seems to me confusing.
Unless we need to expand our notion of empirical consciousness, and that's what I'm asking, whether we need to see. I think, and this is something that's come out in John Hoy's presentation, especially at Cincinnati, that by the end of our discussion with John, we were raising the question of whether we don't need to redefine this whole levels stuff, you know, and whether we don't need some other image of interlocking dimensions of consciousness. What I'm trying to say is that you can have an empirical consciousness that's already heavily affected by intelligence and possibly by rationality, you know, but that is receiving meaningful data is empirical.
But in as much as he lives in a world that's constructed overwhelmingly by my acts of meaning and moorings and so forth, but his appropriation of that, his insertion into it, seems to me also still overwhelmingly to be a function of his own insights into what we mean. And so it's formally intelligible, actually intelligible as meant by us, but only potentially intelligible to him, potentially intelligible to Thomas, but Thomas isn't asking any questions and Abraham is. In that sense, it's not potentially intelligible to Thomas until he gets to the point where he can ask questions. So that's the point on which I'm reluctant to, or I'm not quite sure I see.
Ken is Andy.
Bob, I really like the direction that you're going in this, and I want to offer you a hypothesis, and you can tell me whether this makes sense or whether it's a misunderstanding or what it is. And it goes something like this, what elemental meaning. The hypothesis is that elemental meaning does include operations of insight and judgment, but it does so in a different experiential pattern, which will call for us to rethink what do you mean by empirical consciousness. And the reason I would offer the hypothesis to do this, my son Derek, who's here, is a 7-month-old daughter, and I've been watching, it's extraordinary watching this 7-month-old granddaughter in the pre-linguistic phase kind of manage her body. And for example, I was watching her one day, and as she was trying to reach out and grab something, obviously quite reaching out and grab, but her stomach muscles weren't strong enough that when she reached, her body would move backwards. You know, and so there's this business of, well, I mean, how do you actually reach without? It's sort of like being on a boat. You know, how do you actually reach for the dock without pushing the boat farther?
Ask a person who had a hickory blow.
Yeah. And at a certain point, she got the insight into how to get this muscle, you know, tightened, and that muscle going out both at the same time, so that the movement doesn't do this. And it was an incredible thing to watch her both get the insight and then verify it. And my sense is that that's an example of elemental meaning. So, and there is the operation of understanding. And there is the operation of judgment, but it's in a purely experiential pattern. And that my sense is that's the sort of thing that Lonergan is talking about.
That may very well be the sort of clue to the language of what we're talking about that I need. I'm not satisfied with
it. Yeah.
Danny and Mariel.
Well, thank you very much. That was wonderful. I was wondering about the relevance of the chapter 8 and insight for what you're saying. First thing is that these were long talks about the seniors. Secondly, because if you talk about things concretely, I mean, like that brief is in its meaning, I mean, that is a very pre-verbal given meaning. It has to do with the thing as concrete, so that's the second reason why I can see it in that way. And the third reason is because it seems to me that it is precisely in chapter that what he's saying is relevant to that. It constructs the kitten and the already out there now with.
Right, yeah.
It seems to be a very non-meaning like construction, which is precisely what this whole thing would be with time.
Yeah.
So I was wondering whether, there's any reason why you didn't actually bring up.
Probably because I didn't have the time to think it through any longer. You know, I mean, I just all of this just came to me within the last 2 months, literally 2 months. So I there's a lot more exploration of possible relevant connections that I need to do, and that certainly is one. And you know, before this ever gets published, the language may change quite drastically. For instance, along the lines that Ken just suggested. It really is just exploratory.
Mary Ellen.
I want to just step back in terms of German.
In terms of?
Appropriation. And Father Fred Crowe's Life of the Unborn and appropriating the Lonergan idea. Because he helped me tremendously to understand soul, self-mediation, all of it giving boom at the time of conception. Immaculate conception, all this stuff of, the theory of it or the religious of it, but the concrete giving of the intelligibility at the moment of conception. The bestowing and the consenting, receiving, receptivity. That soul being activated to do all the stuff Ken's talking about, Jeremy's talking about, that's the elemental meaning. And it has to do with marriage, love, and vertical finality. And that's the most element of it. And I'm going to give this to you because I want to say thank you, Father Fred Crowe. He's got the elemental and that he took from.
Okay, Michael?
I don't know if it all makes sense, but I think you're in one of the richest areas of linking Lonergan to so much of 20th century thought, Wittgenstein and Heidegger.
That's what I really want to hear.
At the heart of that is an insistence, partly in opposition to the empiricist tradition, what you might call the linguistically, where you use language in terms of mediated character experience. That's what you're doing here. The second thing is that one of the great attractions and Lonergan, all time. history, one's own personal history, which is a history both of understanding and misunderstanding.
Yeah.
So you need that,
yeah,
that forceful aspect of critical at the end. But also finding himself, like the language is the mother of our intelligence, as it were, and so that whole mediated history that you were born into, that you pre-critically belong to, but the trouble with that is if you lack what you're calling the original meaningfulness dimension, you don't get the dimension of criticism you need. So you need an account that indicates how the very emergence of the capacity for criticism grows out of a pre-critical way of being a subject that has enough authenticity in it to allow you to exercise authenticity. And so I thought the exposition and the genuine erratic character of your talk was terrific, and the final part released you from the charge of geotagging.
Ron? I'd like to comment first. I love that quote from Schuller about the organic mendacity.
Terrific.
Wanaker talks sometimes about insight into data. I think it's very clear that the insight is into the image. And the question is, how do we construct the image? And I think what you say here is very good on that. The image, we must be selective about it by its very nature. And what do we select from to create that image? In fact, I'm wondering if a key characteristic of creative genius is the ability to put together a more complex and realistic image that most people can accomplish. Once you have that, well, as you say, the insight into that is infallible. You see something. And the key to knowledge is to see correctly and to see broadly. I think you've got an excellent start on this whole thing. This whole question of how you construct the image is the key to it. And everybody, I think, contributed a little bit to that point.
Thank you
very much.
Russell? Your discussion of elemental meaning and the analogy of a filter through which mendacity may exist, as I understand it, unconsciously, would suggest that word is also unconscious. Well, I'm thinking of an author, Kristeva, who is a psychoanalyst and a linguist. And she talks about word emerging from the unconscious in a semiotic form. Yesterday in Father Flanagan's talk, I asked whether the word can be unconscious, and his answer was no, very quickly. So I assume that's Lonergan's position. Well, I think you're making a case that that some pre-verbal can be unconscious.
Well, I think I'm saying word and word. The inner word that emerges from insight emerges consciously. No
well,
question.
What I'm asking, I'm suggesting, from what you said, that there is an unconscious aspect to it, and you've just drawn the analogy for it.
Can I respond to that?
Yes.
Just out of my long experience and the practicality of that, my sense is that the truth lies with the idea of image. See, because when we talk about words, they can come out conceptually, but I've been privy to witnessing literally dozens of people retrieve unconscious experience that was bound in some scoptosis, some very traumatic, usually, experience. And when it emerges, and I mean this sitting with a person, as something comes up, it's always symbolic, it's always in an image. And words may be there, but it's a whole clunk that they then experience and then start unpacking. And sometimes words don't come very fast. You know, the image is playing. And when I was hearing your talk, that's what I was resting on. Whether or not it's traumatic is not the issue. That you're dealing with image, as Lonergan said.
Can we get back to
you? Oh, yeah, sorry.
Two prequels. First, just to join the praise for the richness of this talk and all multiple dimensions that it's opening up, just to endorse that, and also to join Ken's implicit rejoinder to Jeremy. Babies have insights before they get to be 8 months old, and they largely have to do with this muscular thing. I think one of the things that's very suggested and intriguing about your presentation is this whole question about the levels and the empirical. I think the idea of undifferentiatedness is kind of crucial. That same chapter where Lonergan talks about elemental meaning and topics in education, there's a point where he in effect, he doesn't quite say it this way, but he in effect says that the meaning of the work of art is the subject who is the beholder of the work of art, and he uses the word ecstatic in that context. Ecstatic, standing out, and I think the gist of it is in an undifferentiated way. So that empirical consciousness is actually a differentiation within that undifferentiatedness. And I think what you're getting at here is the way in which the undifferentiatedness of ourselves as subjects of our Dasein is communicated by tradition and culture, and that then experiencing takes place as a differentiation or as different kinds of differentiation. I think you're right on about that.
I got it. Make some announcements. Thank you, Bob.